good afternoon to you. A good first Friday afternoon to you. I'm Andy Klein, your host of today's Juno Afternoon. And today we've got a full show. We're going to get a preview of this week's Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It's going to be about mountain running in Southeast Alaska, and Dan Lesh and Jeff Rose are here to talk about that. We're also going to be talking to Marie Darlin, who is one of AWARE's Women of Distinction this year. A preview coming up from Perseverance Theater's new play, In the Next Room, the vibrator play. Yes, I said it. And we'll also talk with the Fairbanks Invasion. The musicians from Fairbanks are all here, and their performances this weekend are going to be happening. It's going to be a ton of fun hearing all that great Fairbanks music. That's all coming up. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note. That's all happening coming up in just a minute, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As Republican presidential hopefuls spent Thursday night debating each other in Detroit, Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders was welcomed by thousands of people in Lawrence, Kansas. Voters in Kansas are set to take part in caucuses for both parties Saturday. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, many Native Americans turned out to hear what Sanders had to say and discussed what issues they'd like to see him address.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders spoke to an estimated crowd of 4,200 in Lawrence, Kansas, with many Native Americans in attendance. Haskell Indian Nations University student Andy Weber introduced Sanders.
I think that he is a candidate that will fight for us on our behalf. Bernie Sanders has promised that he will have environmental climate gatherings and will include in tribal nations within the first 100 days of his in office.
Many Native Americans were seen on the stage beside Sanders as he spoke about Native issues.
We will stand with the Native people in making sure that finally they receive the respect and dignity to which they are entitled.
Tribal leaders were able to meet with Senator Sanders before the rally. Kickapoo Tribal Chairman Lester Randall says candidates need to recognize Native concerns.
Well, I think the candidates should acknowledge that the tribes have a long standing here and that our needs are just as important as the non-Natives and people.
Sanders and Hillary Clinton's campaign are courting Native American voters. On the Republican side, Ben Carson, who withdrew from the GOP debate Thursday, reached out to tribal leaders in a video message a few months ago. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
Documents made public this week show the Canadian military has been conducting surveillance on the Akwesasne Mohawk Reservation. It straddles the U.S.-Canada border in New York. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
The 56 pages written by the Canadian Forces National Counterintelligence Unit are heavily redacted, so it's hard to tease out the context of the surveillance. Under the heading Sabotage by Criminals/Terrorists, the documents say Akwesasne is, quote, engaged in smuggling various contraband items, such as counterfeit cigarettes and weapons.
These documents are drafted in response to specific issues or events.
Jorge Barrera is a journalist with the Aboriginal People's Television Network. He acquired the documents. He says a press officer with the Canadian Forces told him they gather intelligence for possible strategic maneuvers, in this case, a naval exercise at an island on the St. Lawrence River owned by the Mohawks.
I mean, one of them was the docking of some warships. So these documents are created to give the military, for lack of a better term, some sort of situational awareness.
The two Akwesasne tribal councils declined to comment for this story. The area has a reputation as a smuggling hotspot. U.S. and Canadian border patrols use aerial unmanned drones to monitor cross-border traffic in the region. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein in Canton, New York.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is expected to meet today with people of the Tsuut'ina First Nation near Calgary, Alberta, Canada. The elders, council, and chief will honor the prime minister by bestowing him with a ceremonial headdress. National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations Perry Bellegarde will attend the event and receive a headdress as well. First Nations leaders say the Prime Minister accepted the invitation to formally meet and be briefed on First Nations issues. Many First Nations across the country are focusing on missing and murdered Aboriginal women, dealing with inadequate water and sanitation, and working on economic development. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at NARF.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Support for programming is provided in part by Karen Crane, candidate for Mayor of Juneau. Paid for by Crane for Mayor, 19191 Randall Road, Juneau, Alaska. Hey, welcome back to a Juneau afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today, and forecast is calling for decreasing clouds with some isolated showers, and then for later on tonight, cloudy, scattered rain showers, and mostly cloudy and slight chance of rain for tomorrow and tomorrow night, so not too much rain, and the next two guys in the studio are probably happy about that because they're out running mountaintops all the time. Dan Lesh and Jeff Rose are with me, and they're going to be doing a Friday fireside lecture tonight at 6:30 and at 8 o'clock at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and it's all about mountain running in southeast Alaska, and you were saying maybe probably more focused a little bit more on Juneau. That's kind of where you guys do most of your running. So tell me, Jeff, I'll turn to you first. How did this, and we were talking a little bit, and Dan, you've got a kind of an interesting backwards story to getting into mountain running, but how did you kind of first get into that? What was your progression to getting into where you're actually running mountains?
Yeah, my progression was kind of the opposite of Dan. I came from a pretty prominent sort of performance-based competitive background. I ran in school and then kind of ran a lot more longer distance ultramarathon stuff over the past 6 or 8 years, but I've sort of stepped away from that. And as I moved more into just getting out and spending a lot of time in the mountains, I kind of over time became less interested in the competitive aspect and just being out in the mountains exploring. But very much my background being so much in, I guess, a more formal running background.
I mean, you look like a runner, right? I mean, you're the kind of person that you look at.
Yeah, I guess I'm more the running,
right? Yeah,
running,
I mean, yeah, right. And Dan, you?
I look like a Sasquatch, according to my wife.
But you have a kind of an opposite story, which is you said mountain running is what got you into other kinds of running.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say more typical background of southeast Alaskans, more of a hiker, skier, hunter, and then I started running and doing this. We're using the word term running, but it's just the sort of a term for moving as fast as you can, kind of in the context that you're in the mountains or trails.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about. So I've done a little bit of that in my life, you know, where you just every now and then you're with people who really want to push it, and you're, especially if you're around familiar ridges or familiar peaks, it feels like, oh, we can go up. Yeah, let's get up Roberts, or let's get up Juneau, and let's do those kind of things, or let's get up and kind of sort of run the Juneau Ridge once we're up there, that kind of stuff. But I always feel like, you know, I've always feel like, well, I don't really run it. I kind of cheat. I just kind of walk fast as much as I can and that kind of stuff. But I guess that counts.
Well,
that's what you're saying. Yeah.
That's essentially what we do. I mean, it's people have this idea. I run into people around town all the time. They're like, wow, you went up Mount Jumbo. You ran up Mount Jumbo today. And I'm just kind of like, yeah. And they're like, really? You ran up Mount Jumbo? And I'm like, well, I mean, no, I walked all the way up. But I like call it running in my mind because I think of running as the most efficient way of moving over the land. And if the land is so steep that you really have to walk, then I sort of think of that as running still. And so
you're trying to do it without stopping as much as possible. You're trying to really, it's about a workout as much as it is about getting up there in a way. Different than maybe a 3-hour hike up Jumbo, where it's more like, oh, let's stop, let's do this, let's, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the
And part of what drives that is certainly the mindset you have, but also the gear that you bring. So you anticipate what you want from the outing. And so And that probably the biggest difference, I think, for the average person here is you'd have a backpack that might not have a waistband, and it might be kind of bulky, and that might not be that fun to run with.
Yeah,
it's going to jostle around a lot. So the difference between what you're talking about and what we're talking about might just be as simple as like a little bit more form-fitting and smaller running pack that you throw your water and your food and map or whatever in. And then when you do decide you want to run down Juno Ridge, it's just that much easier, so you're going to do it a little bit more, and then more on that trip, and then maybe again next time you're going to have a better, even more fond experience, memory of it. So it's just kind of a feedback cycle, and eventually you're going out for 14 hours. And
So it evolves from the stuff that I'm talking about, getting one peak, going up and down, you're done in a couple, you're done in a few hours, to then this other level.
Yeah, eventually you're every time there's a forecast for some good weather, you're thinking, wow, can I free up 12 hours on Saturday? And then you usually end up stretching that into 14.
And there's probably no typical hike, but when you guys think, okay, I think I got 12 to 14 hours Saturday, that forecast I just read sounds okay, maybe we'll go do it. What kind of things are you thinking about doing, loops or doing connecting?
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of, it's a lot of looking at existing trail systems and then figuring out, oh, how can we connect these? You can go up, you go up Mount Roberts to the tram and you end up coming out 12 hours later at Lemon Creek Trail. You end up coming out Heintzelman Ridge, and you look at all these different ways that you can connect these things. Or, I mean, another one we've done together on Douglas Island, you can go up and start out at the very north end of the island, go up Mount Meek and come out 10 or 12 hours later down Mount Jumbo or even south of Jumbo. And so even what seems like this
that,
early...
for a minute there, I was talking to you guys and I was like, these are just like regular guys. They're like me. And then you just said that. And now I think, Jesus, this is, forget it. Are you kidding me?
It comes and goes. That's
amazing to me, idea.
Both of us have had ebbs and flows. Like right now, 4, 5, 6 hours would be a big day for me. A couple of years ago, that would be more like a big day for me. But, life has a way of complicating things. So, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And, that's one of the things we want to communicate tonight is just sharing, the Juno aspect of all this, the Southeast Alaskan aspect. And the neat thing that's kind of fed this very positive influence in my life is just the fact that we have so much ridges that aren't quite as rugged that you can go down them and you have to turn around. I mean, that certainly happens, especially if you go way out the road or travel around. But most of the ridges around here, you can run out one and then you can kind of go around any little steep spot and connect to another ridge. And so that's what kind of keeps you going. You're up there and you're just, thinking, oh, what about that? And once you get that mindset, it's really fun, and it doesn't have to be long. It could be really creative way to get from the tram down to Perseverance, using the trail of the time, but like some side trips and whatever it is, it's about that exploration and just trusting your intuition and yourself and your body and your mind to explore.
Yeah. What are some of the safety measures you guys take when you're going to plan one of these things? What are some of the things you keep in mind to make sure that you're always...
I mean, I think the biggest thing is making sure people know where you're going ahead of time. I mean, really, once you're out there, who knows what's going to come up, and you're never going to be able to prepare for every possible thing that comes up, especially if you're packing very minimal like we do a lot. But so really making sure people know where you're going ahead of time. But I have a little emergency kit I bring with me with a kind of a space blanket and fire starter and basic first aid and some extra calories more than what you figure you're going to need for the run. And
have you gotten into gnarly spots out there? Has that happened in the past 9 or so years you've been running around in Juneau?
I mean, nothing that jumps way out. It was, I would say, a life-threatening situation, but definitely a few.
I mean, it's out there to happen, and in some ways, that's part of what's exciting, mm-hmm. is that you're out there, you really are out there, and that's for even people like me who just hiked up and around in the kind of more general near areas, you have to be careful, and you have mm-hmm. to be mindful, and those kinds of things, but when you're at this kind of faster speed, it kind of seems like it could happen quicker.
Yeah, you have less you're out there for less time, so you're exposed to fewer dangers in some ways, but less time in terms of like any particular area. You're going to be moving through it pretty fast, but yeah, you have less stuff, and a lot of these risks are low probability risks. Just because they haven't happened doesn't mean that you're necessarily doing the right thing. I mean, it's it's a continual learning experience to figure out, you know, what are the right risks and the wrong ones. And, you know, for instance, bears, I mean, I've had really bad experience. Nothing bad happened, but it was no different than the other trip. So
that bear happened to be there and had an attitude or whatever. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a fascinating talk to you guys, and we could sit here and talk about it a lot longer. It'd be fun too, but we don't have to, because if you're listening right now and are interested, you can go tonight at 6:30 or at 8 o'clock, and both Dan Lesh and Jeff Rose are going to be talking about mountain running in Southeast Alaska. It's happening at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center as part of the Friday Fireside Lecture, and thanks to both of you for coming in. Really appreciate it. Have a great talk tonight.
Thanks, Andy.
All right.
Teenage bear, said Uncle Dave, I saw my soul, must be saved. Gonna take a walk down Union Square, you never know where you're gonna find there. You gotta run, 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 take a dragon too. Run, 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 give the devil you. Hey, what to do? Margarita Passion, I had to get her fixed. She wasn't well, she was getting sick. Went to sell her soul, she wasn't high. Didn't know, think she could buy it. She would run, 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 take a dragon too. Run, 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 chip to death in you. Say what you do.
Welcome back to the studios of KTOO for a Juno afternoon. Joining me now are both Sarah Lynn Tabachnik from AWARE and also one of the women of distinction that's going to be honored at the at an award ceremony tomorrow night, Marie Darlin. So, Marie, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you being here. And, Sarah Lynn, thanks again for coming in. Good to see you again.
Pleasure. Thank you, Andy.
Tell me, first of all, a little bit about, just so we can get an idea of this, the award. I'm sure many people have heard the award, the Women of Distinction Award. How do people go about getting nominated? What's that process like every year?
Every year, we solicit from the community nominations. We ask people, think of your neighbors, your friends, your family, women who have done outstanding work in this community, work on behalf of women and children or work on behalf of the community at large. And we get about 20 nominations, or we did this year. The board of directors then has the very difficult job. And I notice I say the board of directors because...
It's not me.
I swear
it's not me.
They review them all and have a big meeting and thankfully come up every year with the four honorees.
What are some of the criteria that the board is looking for?
We're looking for women who do diverse work and work with diverse populations, women who have given over a period of time.
Sort of a body of work
that
people have accumulated. Yeah,
kind of a depth and breadth, and also an integrity and a willingness to share what they've learned and mentor others and just be like solid community citizens and supporters.
I mean, the people that I've known that have been honored with it in the past are just the A-list.
Right.
I mean, it's incredible, really, when you read down the list of the women who've been honored. So, So, Marie, I'm guessing that must feel pretty good.
Well, it certainly is. Yes, joining a group like that.
Tell me a little bit about the work that you've done and what you've kind of been recognized for doing.
Well, I've been involved in a lot of things, they're community-wide organization kinds of things, and then different projects that have been done within the community. And so I've been actively involved in several of those. I also served an elected position on the school board for 6 years back in the 60s. And then I've also served as a volunteer on many boards and commissions and so forth and so on.
Of the work that you've done, is there something that you think of that you're sort of maybe most proud of or that you think was, the most challenging that you've felt you really contributed to? What are some of the standout things?
Well, when I was on the school board, I thought that was challenging, but I'm telling you, I wouldn't want to be on the school board now.
It always seems like a tough job. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was at that time, and with the way things were then. And that was, when there were a lot of things were being put together, let's say, after statehood and so forth and so on. So I started out kind of in education and the schools, the school board and things of that sort, and then went from that to other kinds of organizations that were more actually became women-oriented kinds of topics and things. And then from that, I kind of branched out and went into the history aspect of trying to protect the history of Juneau and spent several years working on those kinds of projects, like the Gastineau Channel Memories books, of which there are now three volumes, which cover about 600 families of Juneau up until about prior to statehood. And so this was an attempt to get down in writing the history of Juneau, let's say. And so that's what I've spent considerable time on. And
and so it seems like, in a way, when you look back on the career that you've had, it's kind of like it sort of flows one thing into the other. And there was maybe looking back, there was a logic to what you did one thing after the other that maybe you didn't even think of at the time, or?
No, I didn't think of it at the time. I mean, working with the schools, which I did, as I said, on the school board, but then also worked on the advisory council for what at that time was the Juneau Douglas Community College, which eventually then, by the time I left that, we were well on our way to becoming UAS, which, is now a very large part of this community. And so with that, again, for some reason or another, it seemed like everything seemed to come back to history. And actually how Juneau had evolved over the years. There were certain projects, too, which were just those projects, one of which was the empty chair, which we just finished over a year ago. And so that, again, that started out more or less in education with the fact that, it was during the Japanese internment, but came directly back to school and the fact of John Tanaka and his special graduation ceremony and all the things that went along with that. But it's always been working with a group, let's say, on different projects kind of things that to me has always been most interesting, is working not just myself doing something, but working with some other group that's all involved in, one thing that we're concentrating on, even if it's only for a short period of time.
You mentioned the women, the work that you did with women, and I know AWARE, of course, is so focused on women's health issues and providing a healthy community for women, and that's a major focus. So I would think that might often plays a role in determining the women of distinction, women who've in particular, maybe done work that helped women's health issues and helped make a safer community for women? Is that something that gets focused on?
I think it's for sure something that the board looks at. And, it kind of jumps out at you when you see that. And the depth and breadth that Marie has
experienced and participated in of support for women and for the community, you know, just from longevity. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really...
When you were focusing on the women's... You mentioned that you focused on women's health issues or education? Or
yes, on both education for women and then also... When Dove Cull came to town, and she was the one that pointed me in the direction of working, you know, with more of the senior and aging population and some of those concerns and the health issues for women, that is where I got involved in some of that.
And so what was it that kind of – what was it you were seeing that needed to be worked on?
Well, the things that needed to be worked on, we knew was, you know, the protection for them, for one thing, and then the services that they needed. And one of the other things, of course, going back to schools, let's say, was the fact of preschool education for kids. And so all of that comes back to women and their role in the community, let's say. And that was one thing, I guess, that I was always interested in was the fact that women should play a large role in any community in just speaking out for what things needed to be done and for their voices be heard. And that was the one thing that, again, coming back to the things that Dove taught all of us, was let your voice be heard. And so that's, you know, kind of the way I've...
It's a powerful message. I mean, it's a message that maybe isn't said as much as it should, you know.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's what I've felt all along. Everything that I worked with, I'm on the State Commission on Aging right now, and we're looking at all those aspects of just the aging population. But when you do that, it always comes to the forefront that there are certain issues that are women's issues that need to be addressed.
Mm. And this latest project that you've been talking about, this historical project, and trying to get what amounts to sort of an oral history, right, of the families of Juneau, these different families, and getting that down as something that's now the third volume has been completed. That's fascinating.
It took us 10 years to do 3 volumes. And what we did was it actually started out as a project of the Pioneers of Alaska here. The committee that we started with actually came from the Pioneers mostly. And then we had some others who came in afterwards. But still, it was the idea that all these stories that everybody hears at times, and I guess it goes back to when they were also trying to put down the stories for the gold rush, let's say,
mm-hmm.
in 89.
The founding
90.
Of, yeah, yes. those kind of
But
stories,
that was,
yeah.
I mean, Juneau had been here for 20 years before that, let's say. And some of our families that we got the stories from went back that far. So it's just a case of wanting to be sure that all this history gets down in writing. And that was what concerned us when they started looking for stories from the Gold Rush days and all of that. And some of us worked a little bit on one of those smaller projects and decided there is so much history in Juneau that has never been put in writing and should be. And so that's where it started from, was the idea that really we need to have this history of some of the pioneers before they're gone. Because, you know, every day there was a new obituary
mm-hmm.
in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a case of feeling that needed to be done.
Capturing all that historical knowledge
right.
that each
and
person
so
has.
And so now it
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
In fact, it's really gratifying to see where people are now using those books to research, use for their research and all, when they say, you know, that one of our resources was, you know, the Gatineau Channel Memories. And I think, oh, it was so worth doing because now it's being used by people that way.
Well, it must be so gratifying to have a body of work where you're able to look at these very different projects you've worked on and think, wow, this had real fruit.
That's
you know,
right.
really bore fruit, and still working on the Alaskan Commission on Aging, and still, still obviously, still in the midst of getting the work done.
Trying to.
Well, Sarah Lynn, tell me just a little bit about the details of the Women of Distinction ceremony that's happening. Are there still, are people still able to go, or is it sold out? Or?
Well, it's almost sold out. We sold over 400 tickets. So if somebody wants a ticket, they want to call 586-6623, like right now.
Now, do it now.
And don't hesitate. And as you said, tomorrow evening, 5:30, doors open. Rob Cohen and his musician guys are going to play some music till 7. We have a silent auction, cash bar.
Is it over at Centennial? Yep,
Centennial Hall. And at 7 o'clock, the program begins.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Marie. Thanks so much, and congratulations on this honor. It really is an honor. And Sarah Lynn from Aware, thanks so much for coming in to both of you, and have a great, fun dinner and ceremony tomorrow night. And congratulations once again.
Thanks
for coming
Andy.
In. Okay. Here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 4th of March, 2016. 1933, on this day, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was inaugurated, having won in a landslide over Herbert Hoover. At the inauguration, Roosevelt was careful to hide the extent to which he'd been crippled by polio. There was a series of wheelchair ramps hidden behind barriers at the Capitol. He walked the last few yards, leaning heavily on the arm of his son James, and he made it look easy, even though it took great strength. His inaugural address included the famous phrase, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." And so it was on this day, 1933, that Frances Perkins took her post as U.S. Secretary of Labor, first woman to serve in the cabinet. She was a New Yorker. She had witnessed the horrible Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, New York City, 1911, 150 garment workers died, and she made workplace safety her first political cause when she went to work for Roosevelt, then governor of New York. Many union leaders did not like the idea of a woman Secretary of Labor, and to blunt their opposition, Frances Perkins dressed like an older woman. She used no makeup, made it a point to stay quiet during meetings, not interrupt people. But she worked to do away with child labor and bring in the 40-hour work week and the Federal Labor Standards Act and Social Security. It's the birthday of the novelist Khaled Hosseini, born in Kabul, Afghanistan, 1965. First novel, The Kite Runner, sold millions of copies around the world, 2003. His next book was A Thousand Splendid Sons in 2007, story of two women in Kabul who are both wives of the same cruel man. Khaled Hosseini, who said, "There's a romantic notion to writing a novel, embarking on a journey, until you're about 50 pages into it. A lot of 50-page unfinished novels are sitting in a lot of drawers across this country. What it takes at that point is discipline. You have to punch in and punch out every day, regardless of whether it's going well. It's largely an act of perseverance. The story really wants to defeat you, and you just have to be more mulish than the story." Here's a poem for today by Jim Harrison, a section from his Livingston Suite. Coozer called from Nebraska to say he'd found a large cinder on a long walk along abandoned country railroad tracks, a remnant of steam trains, the cinder similar to those our fathers shoveled from coal furnaces in the early winter mornings before stoking the fire. In your dark bedroom, you'd hear the scrape of the shovel and the thump when cinders were dropped in metal wash tubs. Now the trains are all diesel, and in Livingston at night I hear them pass, Burlington and Northern, the horn, an immense bassoon, warning the drunks at crossings. Some complain, but I love this night music, imagining that some of the railroad cars are from my youth when I stood in a pasture and thrilled to my favorite route of the Phoebe snow. To be excited by a cinder is to be excited about life. A poem by Jim Harrison from his Livingston Suite, published by Limberlost Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Staples, offering tech services for small businesses like PC setup and repair, some tasks completed by the next day. Staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
I love the colorful clothes you wear, and the way the sunlight plays upon her head. The wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up her vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up.
Oh, good vibrations are in the air at Perseverance Theater. Coming up soon. With the next, in the next room, it's the Vibrator Play, and with me right now are the director, Carolyn Howarth, and one of the principal actors, James Sullivan. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you for
Thanks,
having
Andy.
Us.
This is a fun play, right? It's a little naughty. It's a little bawdy. Am I right?
You are right. It is a little
it's
naughty.
It's adult-themed, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it's a love story.
Right, okay.
Which... love can be pure.
It's also about inventions.
It's also about
it's an inventor story.
Yes.
So maybe, James, maybe I'll ask you to give a quick synopsis of the story if people have not heard about it.
It's a wonderful play that started out in the the setting is in the late 1880s at the invention, at the birth, really, of electricity. As it's just starting to be introduced into households around the country. And one doctor... also inventor, has come up with a way of helping some of his patients. Back in the day, many women suffered from this ailment called hysteria. And he found a way to help
them. They
also
had cases of the vapors.
Yeah.
Often, as I remember. Yes.
Yeah. So he's come up with a wonderful piece of equipment to help these women, as any doctor slash inventor could.
A massager?
Yes.
You would say, maybe? Vibrating massager.
Yes, yes. I think it's as he refers to in the play, electrotherapeutic.
Electromagnetic therapy.
Yes, thank you. Yes, yeah. That's not my line. Obviously, I would have said it right. If it was. That's the doctor's line.
We hope.
Yes.
And then the doctor's wife discovers a possible other alternative use for this new massage therapy tool.
Yes,
she does.
Yes.
Yes. Well, she has just given birth to a child and is suffering a little bit from postpartum depression and also has kind of a somewhat clinical relationship with her husband. He's just very distracted. He's an inventor. He's a wacky inventor. And she discovers through the course of this play that his inventions make her feel things.
Yes.
And... And she's really always looking for his attention. And finally, they sort of have a meeting of the minds.
So to me, this play is fun because there's kind of a big joke in this play, which we're just touched on. Okay.
Yes.
It's a big joke. It's mm-hmm. funny. It's very funny. And I'm sure it's played around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, there's no play could last on just one big joke, right? There needs to be something else going on. So as you're talking about, there's actually, and as you approach this from a director point of view, You have to play that joke right. Like, you don't want to miss the joke.
Right.
You want to get that, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But then you also have to really fill it out with all the other elements of what make a play great and what make it watchable, which are the relationships and those things.
Exactly. There's a lot of very, very, I think, basic human needs and wants in this play from all of the characters, and that is to be loved, to be heard, to be listened to be held, all of those things. And many of them, if not all of them, are searching for that and have various obstacles in order to meet those objectives.
Now, are you the wacky inventor?
No, unfortunately not. Unfortunately not.
What role do you play? I'll
be Mr. Daldry in this one. My wife is one of his first patients. We're having a very tough time. Our relationship is suffering. She is very ill. She is suffering deeply from hysteria, and I've brought her to the doctor, and the doctor is going to cure her and hopefully mend all other parts of our relationship.
Right.
We'll see.
Yeah.
I don't want to give it all away.
Yeah,
right.
But, and then the play, as we were talking about, it's a fairly recently written play. I mean, within the last 10 years or so, it's something like that.
Yeah, I think its original production was in 2009. It was commissioned by Berkeley Rep in California, and then went to Broadway, had a Broadway production, and was a nominee for the Tony, I think, in 2010, and has just been the darling of the regional theater circuit since.
Yeah, and the playwright is who?
Sarah Rule, wonderful playwright. Perseverance patrons might remember we did Eurydice, I believe, 6 years ago. It was one of her first plays she'd ever written, and now we're doing a second one of hers. She's written a whole bunch of plays in the last few years, and she's definitely the most produced contemporary playwright alive today. She's just does a wonderful job. I know you mentioned how this play has a big one joke in it, the vibrator, and what is its true use. But she's one of those people that you can trust that she'll find more meaning into it. She's actually taken the subject matter of the very probably the most intimate moments of one's life, especially of a woman's life, when you talk about sex, and she's also on the another smaller theme about this, as Carolyn mentioned, the main character, Mrs. Givings, played by Christina Apathy, has just given birth. And there's one of the kind of the subplots is how she's having trouble breastfeeding. So she's kind of wrapped all these kind of intimate, very moments that we don't talk about in public much, and produced just come together with an amazing story that is, yes, incredibly funny. But right. Very touching, very real, and it's a very sensitive piece, yes, that's a double entendre joke I just made, but why not?
They kind of all are during this interview.
I've been making them for months. Since we started rehearsals, we've been making them, but it really is. It's a wonderful play, and I'm really glad we're doing it.
And Carolyn, you've been up here to Juno before.
My first trip up here was 5 years ago. I directed The Importance of Being Earnest, and I was up here a couple of summers ago. For Summerfest, I did Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike.
Oh, okay.
And
that was over in the Jack here?
In the Jack, right. Yes. So this is my third trip to the lovely Juno. I love coming here.
Very cool. We were all lamenting the lack of snow a little bit ago. You said when you were here 5 years ago in March, it was piled up to your knees. Yeah.
I know.
What's going on? We don't know what's happening. But so tell me a little bit about, have you directed plays of this ilk before, where you have to balance comedy with this very sensitive subject matter as well? And
sure.
What are some comparable plays that you could remember
doing? Oh, it's the quiz.
I don't know.
If I can remember. You know, really, to be honest with you, almost everything has a combination of tragedy and hilarity. It really does. Whether it's a Shakespeare drama, whether it's a Shakespeare comedy, whether it's something contemporary, I think playwrights write plays about people, and we are simultaneously tragic and hilarious.
Right.
And that's one of the things I love about directing is mining all those moments that are just really human and really real.
Yeah. So when does the play start?
We open March 11th, next Friday.
Pay-as-you-can on
we
Thursday
or something?
We have
some previews before this Sunday, March 6th at 4 p.m., a pay-as-you-can preview. That's our first preview for an audience. And then Wednesday and Thursday night, March 9th and 10th at 7:30 p.m. Those are also pay-as-you-can previews. We open March 11th, and then we run through till April 2nd If anyone sees some of our posters, which have changed recently, we are not doing our last Sunday matinee on April 3rd because we need to break down the set as we bring all our shows to Anchorage. And we're now doing a matinee on April 2nd. So we're doing one Saturday matinee at the last week, and all the other shows are the regular times, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. And, yeah, come on down. It's a great piece of theater. It's fun. It's a wonderful cast. We've got almost an entire Alaskan cast. We have one actor from the Dr. Givings is Torsten Hillhouse. It's his first play here that he's done in Alaska. But he came up here a few years ago and worked at the Sitka Fine Arts Camp back in 2011. And, he's loved it. He's been wanting to come back here. He was cast for this. And then the rest of we have four Juno actors, myself, Enrique Bravo, isn't it? Katie Jensen, who's done a bunch of plays here, was also in Vanya. And Christina Apathy is also in it. And then we rounded out with one actress, Tiffany Cooper from Anchorage, and Margot Lundberg from Skagway, who's people probably recognize her. She was in Oklahoma a couple years ago. And it's a great cast.
Very
I think
cool.
It's just so
yeah.
well cast. Everyone is just really right for the role and just fits in perfectly, and I'm excited to be in it. I'm
All
having
right.
a lot of fun.
So opening night at the 11th. That's opening night, and it is In the Next Room, the Vibrator play, and it's happening at Perseverance Theater. It's the next run. It's obviously going to be a blast and a lot of fun to watch, but as you said, a really well-recognized play, Tony nominated,
mm-hmm.
all that. It's all happening.
Yep.
Carolyn Howarth and James Sullivan, thanks so much for coming in and break a leg.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Coming up next year's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. To the untrained eye, the osprey looks just like a bird of prey should. Talons, hooked beak, vivid yellow eyes. But it also has some characteristics that make it truly unique among raptors, especially when catching fish. In common with most raptors, it has four long toes, three in front and one in back. As the bird reaches for a fish, its outer front toe swivels to the rear, giving it two grasping talons front and back. And those toes are lined with short, stiff spikes for extra grip. The osprey's nostrils shut tight as it hits the water. Then, as it ascends, it shakes itself off, shedding water easily thanks to its oily feathers. In fact, it's the only raptor that has this oily plumage. Its long, slender, arched wings help the osprey get clear of the water, too, as it takes flight with the fish's head facing the front, the most aerodynamically efficient position. This osprey we see today, just one species worldwide, has changed little since tens of millions of years ago, when its ancestors diverged onto a unique evolutionary track, distinct from eagles and hawks, suggesting that over this period, it has remained particularly well-suited to its environment, thanks to these adaptations.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Ice Arena is open 7 days a week, offering drop-in open skating, hockey, and a variety of special events. We are the proud home of the Crimson Bears hockey team, youth, adult, hockey, and figure skating programs. More information at juno.org/parksrec/ice-rink or call 586-0410.
Welcome back to the KTOO studios, where we've been joined by an invasion of Fairbanks musicians. Actually, just two people, Molly McDermott and Matt Roberts are here, both members of the band Harm. And then, Matt, you're also a member of the Barcelona Boys Choir.
Yes, that is correct.
I want to hear all about that band first.
Well, it is an alt-country act. It's very much inspired by the kind of
party culture of what happens kind of in the wintertime up there in Fairbanks.
Okay.
It's a fun bar band. It's a great group of people. Some of my best friends are in that band. I love them all to death.
That's cool. And then Harm I know about because of Annie Bartholomew here in Juneau and over at KXLL and as a member, sometime member, like when she can make it to gigs sort of member, right? But you guys are both in that as well, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And so are you playing, are you gigging a lot in Fairbanks? Is that kind of the thing that you guys are doing most or...?
Over the last year, yes, and we just came off of a tour of the West Coast in January. In the last couple of months, we haven't really gigged much since coming back from that tour because our lead singer, Becca, actually moved to Juneau for this spring, for the couple months.
Okay.
But she'll be hopefully coming back north in April, and then we'll start gigging some more.
Cool. And then there's is it strictly music? Is there a combination of music, spoken word, stuff like that? Or how would you describe what you guys do?
Well, poetry has a lot to do with it. Our beatboxer writes poetry. She is a poet herself. And we take those lyrics or the lyrics that she writes and kind of adjust them sometimes into songs. Rebecca and Heather work together a lot doing that.
And so how does that work in the flow of a concert? Like how does that work in the flow of doing something? Does the music kind of stop and then you're listening to... I mean, you know what I mean? Like you're in a bar atmosphere and then how does it work?
Well, lately
you've
started doing...
I guess is the question. No, that's not sure it works. I'm sure it works.
It seems like it's pretty well. More recently, what we started doing is a mixture where we have Heather perform two poems. And Heather's coming very much from a slam poetry background, so it's very performative and engaging.
She's commanding attention.
Very much.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It's kind of amazing to see those performances because you'll be in a noisy bar and people will just completely shut up and pay attention to to the poem. And so,
yeah, that's cool.
But most of the rest of the poems are actually turned into songs, so they're just the lyrics of the music itself.
Right. And what sort of direction are you guys going in? It's kind of, I was talking to Annie about you guys, you know, went and did it. You went on a West Coast tour, right? You got in a dirty old van and drove around and didn't shower and whatever.
More than in Fairbanks.
This is what I'm talking about. See, this is the music, this is the musician lifestyle, man. You're living the dream. I mean, really, going on tour in a band, it's must have been pretty awesome, right? But grueling too, or what was it like?
I loved it. I don't know. For me, it's touring with four of my best friends again. Like, I feel like I have four big sisters and four little sisters all at the same time, which is awful, but it's also fantastic.
Big sisters.
Little sisters.
See, that was a big sister thing to say, though.
I got to echo Matt, though. We had a really great time on this last tour, and I think it's the best tour I've ever been on. We all get along really well, and it is really fun. It is a lot of work, too, a lot of work setting it up and then just late nights and kind of keeping up the energy and to meet and entertain people and engage them. So it's fun, but it is work.
Yeah. So how did you set it up? Did you work with an agent or something, or did you just, you know, what'd you do?
We mostly booked it ourselves, so we did talk with some people and who are really experienced bookers. And
are there tools about doing that stuff now? Like kind of like, I don't know, online tools or things where you can book gigs? Or?
Yes, email.
Yeah, right.
Social
it's still
media,
the same
Facebook,
thing, right?
Social media, email. Rebecca has a lot of connections, and she does a lot of the groundwork to make those things happen. She's booked quite a few tours for various different bands that typically include herself. So she's got enough connections to make sure that you're not playing to an empty bar. Like, there was – every show that we played was absolutely fantastic. It was – there were no duds in the mix.
That's like, awesome.
Yeah, it was –
because that would be
she
the
does
big
a great
fear,
job
right?
That stuff.
That
yeah.
You know, you get to some place, they don't know who you are.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
It's a Thursday
super
night
bummer.
Or something, you know what I mean? And then,
no, it was really, really well planned
yeah,
out.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's very cool. So tell me how this trip came about to come down to Juneau and to play in Juneau.
Well, that was mostly Annie and Becca planning that because, as I said, Becca came down for these couple months to be in Juneau and worked hard to set up a show with UAS. And so UAS brought us down, which we're really grateful for.
Cool.
Awesome for them
Thank
to
you.
Do. Thank you for the Sound and Motion series that we're going to be doing this evening at 7. And so she put that gig together. And then because Becca is sort of the center of
yes.
a lot of social scenes in Fairbanks. More and more people wanted to come down, and because there's so much music there, and because Annie and Becca were really involved in the music scene, more and more people just started coming together, and so it gradually turned into this kind of mini Fairbanks festival. So there's 8 different bands that are all here this weekend to play.
Yeah, for Friday and Saturday.
So do you think, is there a real scene?
Oh, absolutely.
In Fairbanks kind of developing? Because I don't, in Juneau, I think there's a small one, but it's sort of, there's sort of, I'd say there's maybe 4 or 5 really excellent, prominent kind of bands. But it doesn't, but they don't necessarily share members, and there's not necessarily that sort of thing happening where there's this kind of collaborative scene as much as it sounds like there might be more of that happening in Fairbanks.
No, one of the great things about Fairbanks is you truly have a community that supports each other, and you have, everyone wants each other to succeed. No one is trying to step on each other's necks, trying to, like, get that gig at whatever bar that is that night or whatever house show that is that night. There's a lot more support there that I've seen in any other place that I've been and played music in.
Yeah, and just like you said, there's a lot of crossover between the different groups, you know, sharing members. There's some people having solo projects, like within Harm, I think. 3 of us have solo projects, and everyone's in other bands. So, and everyone's very supportive of all of those different projects.
You guys met in school. Are you guys now working? Are you still in school, some of the band members? Or how does that shake out, and how does it change your commitment and ability to do the band?
Some of us met in school. Some of us didn't, actually. It's kind of a very just member-to-member. But none of us are currently in school besides Molly studying birds.
Yeah. I'm a grad student at UAF. So,
you stuff birds?
No.
Is that what you just said?
No, I study birds.
Study birds. I thought you said stuff birds. Like, I was like, all right, let's go down that path.
Yeah.
No. But you study birds?
I study birds and insects, yep.
Well, that's really...
Yeah.
That's very cool.
It's very fun, yeah.
Yeah. And working on a master's or your master's degree on that? Okay. Yeah, very good. And but so how does work and the commitment of having to make money, right, and all that and just have a job, then how does that – must be harder in a way than – to me it seems like it would be harder than when you're in a school environment where your time's a little bit more flexible, you know?
I don't know. I always – if you love it, you do it. You find a way to make it work. So you make it work.
Yeah.
A lot of us are fortunate to have kind of flexible jobs or flexible schedules. That definitely helps when you're touring or gigging. And then some people, like Matt and Annie, both work in the music industry. So there's, I think, more understanding and appreciation.
Yeah.
I guess I can't speak for you, but that's sort of my perception of it.
I think she just did, though. Big sister.
On the UAF concert board. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, it sounds awesome, you guys. It's going to be Sound in Motion. That's happening 7 o'clock tonight out at UAS.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Just Harm playing that show?
Correct.
Right? Yeah. Okay. And then as the weekend kind of progresses, there's other stuff happening, mostly Saturday? Or is there a specific place? Or
later on tonight at 9 o'clock at the Alaskan, we'll also be playing our first half of the invasion. You'll see Kitty Wake, Barcelona Boys Choir, and DJ B. Gross. This is going to be emceed by... Donald Crocker, a.k.a. Filipino Heat.
Okay, that all sounds amazing. And then that's later tonight at the Alaskan.
Yeah,
so
9 p.m.
9 p.m. at the Alaskan when that starts. Yeah.
21 and up, please show up. It'll be fun.
Cool. And then
and
what's
then,
happening Saturday, yeah.
Yeah, tomorrow night, also free, 9 p.m. at the Alaskan. Dan Furman, excellent singer-songwriter, is playing. And then Kat Moore's solo project from Super Saturated Sugar Strings, some people might know. The Forest That Never Sleeps, and then Annie Where the Sun Don't Shine, Annie Bartholomew's band, and then us with Harm, and then DJ B. Gross again closing out the night.
All right. So. Wow. Packed little festival.
Yeah.
I love
mini
it.
Mini Fairbanks Festival.
Yeah, like a Junaroo down here or something. I don't know. Fairbanks-aroo. I don't know. Listen, I've just got these ideas, and I'm throwing them out here on air. Come on. It's live radio. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. I appreciate it. That's Matt Roberts and Molly McDermott, both from Harm. They're playing tonight at the Sound in Motion out at UAS at 7, then at 9 at the Alaskan tonight, and again at 9 tomorrow night. Different bands all happening, different Fairbanks bands, big mix of stuff. Going to be very cool. A little slice of the far north down here in southeast Alaska. Thanks so much for you guys for coming in.
Yeah,
I really
thanks
appreciate
for having
it. All right.
Yeah.
And that's it for a Juno afternoon, this first Friday afternoon. So much going on. First Friday is always wild. So lots of stuff happening between the Fireside Lecture out at the Mendenhall Glacier Center, of course, the Sound of Motion we were just talking about, and later on at the Alaskan. And, of course, First Friday is happening. So people are out there right now walking around town, starting in just the next half hour and checking out art. And I know the Brewery Depot will be serving some samples, so I'll see you there if you're stopping by that way, and probably at the Alaskan later tonight to go see these great Fairbanks musicians. Thanks to all of my guests who joined me today, and thank you for listening. That's a Juno afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, and have a great weekend.
He's trying to con people into giving them their vote, just like he conned these people into giving them their money.
Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz go after Donald Trump in one of the most contentious Republican debates yet.
For Friday, March 4th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Kelly McEvers.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Next, we'll hear more about the debate and the state of the Republican Party now that a Stop Trump wing is emerging.
Plus, we'll hear how far one man went to avoid paying taxes.
When somebody comes and takes 50% of my income and don't even have the courtesy of pointing a